Hey, glad you can make it. And welcome to the Employee Cycle Podcast, where we talk to HR innovators, thought leaders, and even some disruptors about the latest in HR trends, HR tech, and you guessed it, HR data. Well, you've heard enough of me talking. Now let's start the show. Before we begin, let's hear a quick message from our sponsor.
Hello, HR. It's me, your HR data. And I need to apologize. I'm sorry for being all over the place. I'm sorry for being difficult. I'm sorry for not being there for you. But it's not my fault. You put me in different HR systems and messy spreadsheets. But guess what? I now have a new friend, and their name is Employee Cycle. They can put all of me in one HR dashboard for you and keep me updated and simple so we'll better understand each other. Look, we're smarter when we're working together, so if you want me to show you my full potential, please go to employeecycle.com to get your free demo today. That's employeecycle.com. Promise me you'll go. Our relationship depends on it.
Hello out there, and welcome back to the Employee Cycle Podcast. I'm your host for today, Bruce Marable, and I have a special guest today, Anna Greenwald, the founder of On The Goga. And today we're going to be talking about, does wellness work at work? Anna, welcome to the podcast.
Yay! Nice warm welcome. It's awesome to be on the podcast, Bruce. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're quite welcome. So today we're going to talk about, does wellness work at work? I think you know a little bit about wellness. But before we really go into the topic, can you give the listeners some background and context into how you got to the place you are today with On The Goga and how that fits into the wonderful world of HR?
Totally. Okay, so I won't go into the long story because that will take forever. But essentially, I was the person who hated the proselytizing yogi friends who were like, oh my God, you got to come to this 105 degree yoga class. It's going to be great. You know, I was the kind of person who always wanted to be healthy, always wanted to, you know, be active, feel good in my body, but never really had a means of getting there and had a very kind of defined sense of self that was antithetical to, you know, the yogis or the athlete or, you know, just the person in general who meal preps and does all the crazy stuff you see on Instagram. So my kind of segue into wellness was through yoga. I came to it by accident, through a vocal injury that I had when I was, I went to school originally for music and found this practice of yoga is this really transformative health practice that helped me reset my body, helped me reset my mind, helped me reset so many different things in my life. And as I kind of came to understand more about the science behind why this act of noticing simply where you are creates such a big impact in your life, it became my focus. So I have been working at a digital marketing in a digital marketing role at a music industry company. And this kind of slowly kept pulling me more and more as my own personal focus. This idea of wellness, this idea of, you know, practicing a lifestyle that you want to have and then kind of bringing it into, you know, every day. At this time, I was working at an office. And so I kind of got that feeling of the office lifestyle, you know, the stress, the anxiety, the long hours, the expectations that are set on you. And On The Goga started as kind of me breaking away from that role in that company and starting a company where my sole goal was just to bring yoga to people who wouldn't normally try it, because that was 100% me. Mm-hmm. That's why it's On The Goga, the original name. And in doing that, we came into companies because, you know, that was one of the places where this act of yoga, this act of calming your mind, getting connected with your body, getting connected to the things that are really important to you, was the most important, right? When you're at work and you feel like you're inside of the computer and there's a million meetings and meetings about meetings and things that you have to get to. And through yoga in the workplace, started to look around and say, you know, there's a huge need for this practice, not just the physical practice of yoga, but the practice of mindfulness, the practice of, you know, empowering people to create their own happiness, that create their own positive habits. And from there, you know, we kind of got lumped into this corporate wellness realm. And I'm in this realm learning about all these corporate wellness solutions, looking around and thinking, you know, there needs to be more here than what there is. There needs to be programming and programs that are built around creating a culture of self-empowerment and really just caring about and caring for the employees, which is what I was finding a lot of companies wanted to do, but weren't being offered the resources to do. So On the Goga is a corporate wellness company that's guided by the principle that happy people do great things. So instead of being claims driven, we're a lot about providing wellness as a resource for creating company culture that retains and attracts top talent and over time helps companies to create a workforce that is happier, that is healthier of their own volition.
Nice. So today's topic is, does wellness work at work? So the first question I have to ask you is, what the hell is wellness? What is mindfulness? And the reason why I'm asking this, you know, most of the people who are listening to our podcast are HR leaders and professionals. And from where the industry is going, most HR leaders are trying to get as far away as possible from the feel-good birthday parties, walking around giving everybody a back rub type of perception that people have of HR. So now someone like yourself comes in to the picture and says, no, we need to do wellness and yoga and make people feel good. So let's talk about what wellness is and why this is just as important as employee engagement and performance and training and everything else an HR person does.
Absolutely. So there's a couple different parts of your questions that I'll answer kind of in sequence to help kind of give an impression of where I come from. So a lot of wellness, right? People think about wellness programs as they're generally advertised. And we're thinking about essentially two different elements, your wellness screenings, right? So your HRAs, your biometric testing, internal surveying, external surveying, and then your interventions. So your lunch and learns and your massage on site or your, you know, discussions about how stress affects you in the workplace. And a lot of the times wellness is approached as, what are our claims? How can we drive those claims down through identifying and then providing preventative services in the workplace? And that's how a lot of people approach this concept of wellness. And now HR, like you said, has a million things on your plate, right? You've got all of your open enrollment. You've got all the things you need to do day to day. You've got a whole host of just tasks that you need to do for HR. And now someone's coming to you and saying, hey, human resources, you know, people operations, can you also make sure that we're doing yoga every week? Make sure that, you know, we're doing lunch and learns and learning about our heart health or how to lower our chances for acquiring type 2 diabetes over time through lifestyle choices. And also, can you make sure that everybody's super excited about it and super happy to be there and that we have like 80% engagement? And that kind of concept of wellness is something that I challenge. Because when you look online at all of the research, when you listen to the talks of the leading, you know, positive psychologists and organizational development thought leaders, what they're seeing through these programs that are really claims driven, really metrics oriented on the short term, like how can we drive health premiums down? We're seeing that the correlation between that type of wellness program and that ROI, that maximizing of the bottom line that everybody's super concerned about in the short term, people are left feeling like, is this really working? And so I would, you know, kind of offer up a different approach to the concept of wellness. You said, you know, how is wellness related to engagement? I would say that wellness is a tool for engagement. Corporate wellness is an opportunity to attract and retain top talent, young talent, and to grow employee loyalty and engagement by creating a strong and supportive culture. not a means to maximize your bottom line. So the way that kind of we break down wellness is not just what are the claims, what are some preventative things we can do to focus purely on healthcare. We think about wellness in a holistic way. And I sometimes hesitate to use the word holistic because people hear holistic and they think, you know, they think of holistic medicine or, you know, we're going to rub crystals together and cleanse your third chakra.
I mean, when I hear holistic, I think of whole foods.
Right. Well, let's be real. Whole foods is great. But the actual definition of holistic is something that's characterized by a comprehension of the parts of something as intimately interconnected and explicable only to be referenced to the whole. That's the Merriam-Webster Dictionary of Holistic. So understanding that wellness is not about getting Sally Joe to lose 20 pounds and then giving her a sticker for it. Wellness is about connecting to your employees, listening and asking them, what's going to make you feel like your day here at work is valuable and meaningful and driving your life in a direction that makes you feel good about yourself. That's wellness. So when we work with companies around wellness, we're not talking about how can we, you know, lower your healthcare premiums. That may be a beautiful side effect that happens over time. Through a lot of the studies that have been done, it takes about 5 years of like consistent engagement in a wellness program to really start to see those results in terms of healthcare premiums. But what we can focus on is creating a positive work environment that not only sets people up in a, you know, positive psychology way to produce more and to be at their maximum productivity and efficiency, but also creates an environment where people are happy and excited to go to work, where people are treating employee loyalty with the same vigor that they're handling their customer loyalty, where, you know, you attract these younger talent into your company because they're coming in for an interview and they're seeing, wow, like they bring in massage every week. They have opportunities for employee assistance programs. They have amazing healthy catered lunches. They have town halls. They have mentorship programs. You know, they have financial health classes. This is a place where I can really make a life. And, you know, in that way, yeah, throw a birthday party, right? Like I love birthdays, you know, but for your company, maybe that means throwing a birthday party. Maybe that means bringing in someone else to give the back rubs, right? Maybe that means simply giving flex days and, you know, allowing employees to work from home. It's approaching wellness in a holistic way that combines wellness as a tool for professional development and organizational development towards fair policies.
I love that you're so passionate about this. We're going to have an awesome conversation. But one of the parts of my previous question, I still want to dig a little deeper into. So you were there the other night when I was hosting the most recent Disrupt HR Philly event, and I made a joke about how HR keeps changing its name from personnel to HR to people operations. And although I was being funny about it, it is true that as you move through this life cycle of names and maturity in the role, HR has become, especially with the people operations role, has become a lot more thoughtful, a lot more strategic, a lot more data-driven. So getting from just personnel management, or let's just call HR, human resources, from this stigma of feel good, happy-go-lucky, I just make sure that people feel good, but then when it's time to fire people, I do that, but I'm not necessarily strategic. For the people who want to break out of that stigma and break out of that mold and say, hey, I am strategic, I am thoughtful, I am data-driven, how do you muster up the courage to now say, oh, but by the way, now I want to give everybody yoga and make everybody feel good.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, here's how I approach that, because I'm an extremely analytical person. You know, I'm the type of person who you can tell me a million times how great, you know, mindfulness is for your productivity, but I need to see that scholarly reviewed article about it. And I need to understand the physiology behind, you know, how is this affecting my brain? And I think that for me is my answer to that question. that this concept of, you know, happy-go-lucky, oh, it's my job to make everyone happy and all that stuff, that is analytical and data-driven. When you look at positive psychology as it relates to organizational development, there's an amazing book called The Happiness Advantage by Sean Aker that talks all about how positive psychology fuels success and performance at work. There's so many resources out there that as HR professionals, you know, we have access to now that 10 years ago, 15 years ago, there just wasn't this research around about why, you know, creating these positive work environments and creating these, you know, situations of personal and professional development combined into one place, those things drive the bottom line. You know, they're not warm and fuzzies that are nice to haves. They're must haves if you're going to keep moving your organization to the front of the pack, to attracting the top talent, to getting people to come in and invest themselves, like their best work, into what you're doing. So I think that that's probably where I would say the shift can occur. It's not away from doing things that make people feel good. It's towards doing things that make people feel good, but also educating ourselves and explaining, you know, why are we doing these things? A, I think fundamentally, you know, it's because you care. That is a prerequisite, in my opinion, for having a successful wellness program, right? Like if a company, you know, doesn't, I think all of the people, you know, who listen to your podcast, they probably don't belong to one of these companies because, you know, they're going out of their way to educate themselves on how to maximize their, you know, productivity and efficiency and impact in their organizations. But if your company doesn't care about the quality of life of your employees, then your wellness program is not going to pan out and you probably shouldn't invest time into it. But if you're an HR professional who really cares, who's working for a company that gives you the tools and the resources to care for your employees, and you take that and you drive that towards, you know, research-based wellness programming, so mindfulness, anything that allows the people in your organization to feel cared about and supported, that's actually going to maximize that bottom line, to drive those efficiencies. And there are ways to collect data around happiness and engagement at work that are, you know, data driven. There are a couple of really amazing organizations out there. One of them actually was one of the sponsors at the Disrupt HR event. And you know, the people behind the Best Places to Work survey, there's a great company out there called Happiness Works that uses data-driven metrics to measure happiness and engagement at work. And I think that's really the key. It's not, if you're running away from the warm and fuzzies, like take a moment, stop, breathe, and figure out how to run back towards it in a way that can be backed by all of that data and that science that you're going for.
Got it. So I know a little bit about your company, and you've been working with companies of all sizes and all industries, correct? So without Yes. naming the companies, could you just talk about the employee range of companies you've been working with?
Yeah, most
and
definitely.
The industry. And the reason why I'm asking that, I'm always trying to put myself in the shoes of the listener who wants to ask questions, but obviously can't. So I'm assuming that someone out there is thinking, great, I work at a law firm. I work at an accounting firm. I work at some type of firm that you would think would be stereotypically very conservative. You know, I don't work at one of those fancy pants tech companies in the Valley where they have ping pong tables and pool tables and water slides and whole food chefs cooking food all day. I don't have that. So can you give some context and talk about the types of companies you're working with, and especially if there are any of them are stereotypically conservative, how they've embraced this?
Most definitely. So I think that from my perspective, that's really our job, right? The Googles and the Facebooks and the Uber, well, maybe not the Ubers, but, you know, they have it already. You know, they have this infrastructure, the Patagonias, right? Like that's the quintessential, beacon of corporate culture in a lot of ways. You know, they've got this stuff going on. So that is the question. It's like, how do we start? And with every single one of our companies that we work with, we approach it, the process, from the philosophy of start small. So I'll take an example. One of the companies that we've worked with for pretty much the entire time that we've been in business. And they started simply as a corporate yoga program, and they've moved into now doing everything from mindfulness to, you know, wellness workshops that span all five pillars of wellness that we work from, which are physical fitness, emotional well-being, financial health, community support, and environmental stability. So they're an accounting firm. We work at one of their offices in Philadelphia and one of their offices out in Bluebell. And they started with Saturday yoga during busy season. So that seems really simple, right? Saturday yoga during busy season. But the reason that they did it was because these employees are coming into work on a Saturday and they have to be there, right? And they brought in yoga and a catered lunch every Saturday. Simply what that's doing is that is taking the effort, the time to show these employees, hey, we recognize that you are putting in hours and that you're here on a Saturday. There's not much that we can do about that. It's busy season, accountants, we need to be here on Saturdays, but we want you guys to feel that we understand and we are supporting you. So they're giving them these tangible things, food that fuels their brain for the rest of the day, and a break of exercise and mindfulness that's going to set them up physiologically for the most productivity and lowest stress levels for the rest of their day. So, you know, that's how they started. Now they incorporate programming throughout the entire year. Everything from mindfulness-based stress reduction courses to healthy integration courses that teach people how to integrate healthy behaviors into their daily lifestyle. And these classes, the desk yoga classes, they serve as community functions where people take 15 minutes. They're encouraged to take 15 minutes to an hour to come away from their desks and do something that the company knows is going to further what they're doing. So that's kind of an example of how an accounting firm that is not going to, you know, redo their whole office to build in the water slides can start this wellness programming that's really focused around creating these year-long environments where people can and are encouraged to take time for themselves to improve their own physical and mental well-being. And then that translates back into better work. So that's an example of an accounting firm. We've worked with everyone from, you know, creative agencies where we've done, you know, mindful happy hours where we bring beer into the workplace to attract even the cynics and talk about, you know, what mindfulness is. Because a lot of the times people have these lofty ideas, right? And you think that you can't get the curmudgeon who sits in the back of the office never engaging in anything to buy into mindfulness, but the reality is that if you can approach it in a way that makes sense to people and that they can realize like, oh, I'm already doing a lot of that work, they can buy in. Or we've worked with, you know, warehouse workers where we go out and instead of doing a yoga class, it's doing a functional movement class with them, getting them up, getting them ready for the rest of the day. And then from there, what we do in all of our programs, which I think is the key takeaway from, you know, the initial discussion about wellness, is you have to ask your employees what they need and what's going to work for them, right? So when we go into a warehouse and we have our discovery program with a group of warehouse workers, you know, they're not wanting to take 60 minutes out of their day to, you know, learn about different mindfulness techniques for sales. That just doesn't apply, but they are interested in 10 to 15 minute breaks multiple times a week where they can relieve physical tension. They can learn how to make like a quick $5 lunch that they can bring into the office. And you know, our workshops are always responsive to the employee needs, the employee interests, and the employer interests, right? Figuring out where those two line up, the employee interests and the employer interests, and finding just small ways to start adding in these, what might seem like simple, easy little workshops or events for your employees, but they're really resources. They're really, the foundation of the culture of it's okay to take time for yourself because this is going to make you a better person and our company a better company. And B, you know, getting people keyed into wellness is not juicing kale every day and running marathons. You know, wellness is taking a moment to breathe, and taking a moment to notice, you know, where you are, where your thoughts are at, how you could make one small change to set yourself up for a slightly better day. And if you repeat that over time, you're creating a culture that encourages happiness, that encourages, you know, personal growth. And that starts to show itself in the way that your employees are interacting with each other and their work.
So because you're working with so many different types of companies, it sounds like you said warehouse, which may or may not be manufacturing, consulting, accounting, etc. Are you dealing with the same type of internal champion? Meaning, is it always HR that's your point of contact or internal champion? Or depending on the size, nature, or industry, is it a department leader? Sometimes is it the CEO? And who do you think is best fit to be the internal champion for what you do?
Yeah, so just like any other part of the wellness program, right? That is going to be wholly dependent upon the company. Because I could sit here and tell you that HR is the best person to go through for something like this. But 9 times out of 10, the HR person's going to say, you know, I don't have time for this. So whether it's an HR champion, whether it's, you know, an employee that's entire, we've worked with companies before where they have employees, their whole job is employee wellness and engagement. And that's fantastic. But it might be an HR champion. It might be a wellness committee. We have one client where a sales associate is our main point of contact who helps us to organize all the programming, you know, get people involved, spread engagement. And so that's kind of the lead-in point of contact, right? That's a little bit different than a champion. A champion can also come from a myriad of different places, right? You can have ambassadors of varying roles within the company. You need to have a leadership, at least leadership buy-in and excitement about creating this type of culture in the workplace. But having leadership that are champions, that are coming to the programs, like that's incredibly helpful. And when the company is set up in a way where that's possible, it really does a lot to drive uptake and engagement in these types of programs. And, you know, sometimes these ambassadors come out of the strangest places, right? Sometimes it's the office manager who sits at the front desk every day and tells people about, you know, what's going on. And in that kind of larger scope, it's really about finding what works for your company. When we talk about corporate wellness with our clients internally, we're constantly bringing it back to the metaphor of an individual, right? If you're a personal trainer or a life coach that's trying to, you know, help a varied different groups of people achieve their best life, you're not going to, you know, take Jim and Mary on a 10-mile run every day, right? Like, depending on their lifestyle, depending on their time, how much, you know, money they have, how much responsibility they have day to day, you're going to start in different ways to figure out what's the best way to champion this with them. What's the best programming to do with them? You know, what are our focuses going to be? So champions, programming, you know, how you start the program, that's all really, really dependent upon your company. And just as an HR person, you know, you're probably one of the people in the company that is most set up to kind of do that initial temperature taking, to see, you know the ins and outs of your people. Look around, ask questions, figure out how you can start small with your company. What do people need? What do people want? What's going to make people feel supported? And then how can you take small steps to move towards that as a goal?
So one of the reasons why a lot of HR leaders love our podcast is because we like to get down and dirty into the details. And we also like to create a plan for whatever the topic is that we're talking about. So you just spoke about buy-in. So let's start there. Before any executive or leader in a company does anything, they need to get buy-in. So if someone wants to get buy-in, because I'm sure you've coached different roles, whether it's the HR person, whether it's the wellness committee, regardless of who they are, how have you seen them get buy-in to do any type of mindfulness or wellness program, and what are the benefits that they're selling to whoever they need to talk to get the buy-in for them to believe that this is worth the cost and the investment?
So I think that, you know, buy-in in this way, there's two types of buy-in, right? There's the buy-in of the person who signs the checks, and then there's the buy-in of the employees to actually participate in the program. So if you're talking about, I think if you're talking about either one, there's a kind of a fundamental base layer to that concept of buy-in, which is something that seems so intuitive, it almost sounds stupid, but it's actually the prerequisite for creating a program like this, a culture-based program that's really going to work. And that is the funny word that at Disrupt HR last week, you know, we pointed out has a lot of different, you know, meetings and might not fit in every context, but it's authenticity. The foundation of your wellness program needs to come from a place of caring. If you are going to advocate a walking meetings policy at your company, the benefits of walking meetings are bountiful. You can, you know, look at the research of how, you know, ideas are generated through getting up, getting out into nature, changing place, moving as you're thinking. But the crucial part of it just has to be that you want to provide your employees with, you know, a chance to get up and move, a chance to get up and break that standard sitting at your desk all day. You need to be doing this because you really want to create a wonderful place to work. Now, if you have that foundation, getting buy-in from upper management that's the process that we were talking about earlier. That's taking these ideas of the type of work environment that we want to create and quantifying that in terms of, hey, you know, this is what we're trying to do. This is why we're trying to do it, because people are asking for it, because people want it, because this is something that's really going to make a difference. And if we can do that, you know, here are the ways that that's going to help us to retain the people at our company who, you know, are looking for a high quality of life. And, you know, buy-in, I think, is also crucial to incorporate into that conversation with upper management. How are we going to show off these things that we're doing that are making a difference? You know, how are we going to integrate this into the recruitment process? How are we going to integrate this into when we talk to an interview talent that's coming in? So talking about buy-in from the person who's signing the check, it's really taking these meaningful, authentic programs that are based around, you know, what's going to work for your company, and explaining that to upper management of, this is what we're going to create. This is who it's going to like please and serve. And here's why doing these things is going to boost their productivity, which through, you know, positive psychology. I'll take a step back because I like to get into, you know, the statistics of these types of things, like the research behind it. In that book, The Happiness Advantage, Sean Aker talks about, you know, our brain productivity in terms of, he says, your brain works significantly better at a positive state than in a negative, neutral, or stressed state. Every single business and educational outcome improves when we start at a positive state rather than waiting for a future success. Sales improve 37% across industries, productivity is boosted by 31%, and you're 40% more likely to receive a promotion. Nearly 10 times more engaged at work, people live longer, get better grades, symptoms are less acute, and much more. So if you can take these, you know, authentic programs that are really meaningful and based in, you know, setting your employees up for their most positive workday and therefore their most positive day and their most positive lives, these are the types of results we're going to get from that, also tying in recruitment. And employee buy-in at that point is simple because you're really just saying to people, you're asking people first and foremost, what do you want? What's going to make you happier at work? And then you're championing them and saying, you know, hey, we're going to make this happen and here's how we're going to start. And by giving them what they want, not what you think they want, not what, you know, X or Y or Z wellness portal is going to say that they're going to engage with, just asking them what they want and then finding ways to deliver on that, you know, in the short term and in the long term. That's all the buy-in that you need. It's not about how do we convince people how to buy into this program that we don't know if it's going to work. It's how do we create the program that's going to work based on feedback? And then how do we communicate to people, hey, we're here, we've listened to you, this is what we're doing. And then all you have to do is show that off to the people outside of your organization and say, look at all this awesome stuff that we're doing. You know, here's why you want to work at our company. And, you know, so that kind of touches on employee buy-in is simple when you're doing things that matter. And employer buy-in is about taking those things, showing them why you're doing them, how you're going to do them, and explaining how, you know, that buy-in is crucial for getting these programs running. And it's going to come back through employee loyalty, employee recruitment, and overall productivity gains.
Wow, that was awesome. And at the beginning of this answer, you said it's up to the HR person to quantify what they want to do and where they want to go. But in the beginning of the interview, you said you have a problem with people associating this with actually lowering healthcare costs and other things. So if you're going to quantify this, what type of data and metrics are you looking at to improve or benchmark based off of where you are today and where you will be in 6 months, 12 months, however long your corporate wellness program lasts?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's a really important distinction to make. When I say, you know, you want to quantify this, it's not how much are we lowering our healthcare costs. You know, in fact, I put healthcare costs and premiums on the back burner when I talk about wellness programs, because what we're really talking about is using wellness as a vehicle for culture development. So what you want to look into in a, what are you really doing with your culture? Well, first of all, you're creating an environment where people work and communicate and function well together around common visions and values. So the things that you can start to quantify are the, simply, you know, how many people in your organization understand and resonate with the values of your organization? How many people in your organization feel that, you know, your organization is practicing its values within its employee relationships in the same way that it's, you know, advertising them out to the customers? You can, you know, and these, a lot of these are questions that, discussions that need to take place between, you know, whoever is, I say HR because that is the expectation of a lot of companies, is that HR is going to take this on. And that's, you know, probably a lot of you listening are in HR. And if this is something that you've been tasked with or something that's important to you, you know, these are the types of ways that you can start this conversation around a different way to quantify. So, you know, taking, having these conversations between HR or the responsible party and the rest of the employees, and, you know, making notes of those conversations, making notes about how people's, just like you would talk to a customer, right? And a customer satisfaction, you know, it's like employee satisfaction over time. How many people believe that the company is really starting to practice its own values? How many people, you know, come into work each day and feel safe? How many people come into work each day and feel that they can talk to their manager when there's a problem, feel like they know somebody on their team? There are a lot of great resources out there for collecting this kind of happiness and engagement data within your company. So you can go to a third party to collect this data. Like, this is something that we do with our clients, but you can collect it, you know, through conversation. So that's kind of one way, is, you know, how are people who are currently at your organization feeling about being at your organization? Another way to start to quantify this data is to look at, you know, when you're in the recruiting process. Start now asking people, you know, how much of the reason that you're accepted, that you just accepted our job, or that you reached out to us with your resume, or that you accepted this interview, is because of our company culture. You know, and if you have no company culture, company wellness program, or initiatives that are based around, you know, making your workplace a wonderful place to live, those numbers are probably going to be pretty low. So then you start with your culture programming, your wellness programming. and you start building. What we do with all of our clients is a fundamental part of this is building the internal culture brand. So looking at the company's visions and values, making sure that those are being practiced throughout the organization, you know, having a standard way that people are communicated with when there is an event coming up or a resource, integrating that with your open enrollment, talking about your visions and values throughout the hiring process, you know, having these wellness events on site. Maybe you have therapy animals that come in once a month. You know, maybe people vote each month for what do we want to do this month to make the workplace a happier place to be? And then they do that. And then you start to, what we start to do is we record photos, videos, testimonials, and you start to integrate those into your hiring process. There was a lot of talk about that at Disrupt HR earlier this week about, you know, how to take these experiences that are naturally and truly occurring in your workplace and show them off. And then a year later, when you have all these things up on the website, it's pulsing through your social media, it's all over LinkedIn, it's part of your job descriptions that you're putting up online, that you're putting out with your recruiting team. And you ask someone, how much of the reason that you took our interview, that you took our job, is due to, you know, the culture at our company? Those numbers, if you're really actively doing things on site, those numbers are going to change. And what I think is so important about this phenomenon, really, the using culture, authentic demonstration of what you're doing to attract young talent, are just the fact that this is HR for millennials. That's how I really believe culture and wellness is tied into HR. Culture and wellness is recruitment for millennials. These millennials are buying experiences, not just of your recruiting process, but of their days and lives at work. There's a statistic on Forbes that young people are apt to take a 7% lower salary in departments and organizations that have a strong culture and culture that represents their personal visions and values. So, you know, these young people, and you know, I'm a part of this generation. It's like we are excited to work for a company that is making a difference and is making, you know, my life, whether I'm an accountant, whether I'm, you know, manufacturing things in a warehouse, whether I'm a creative, strictly business management, HR, if my company is aligned with my visions and values, I'm going to work at the place that lets me take off and have flex days, even if they're paying me $5,000 less every year, because I can't buy that time back. And at that value, especially in young talent, you know, you can't fake that. You have to build it slowly over time, integrate it into your organization, and then show it off. Like when you're asking, how do I get people to, you know, buy into our corporate culture? It's like, do awesome stuff and then talk about it.
Yes.
So yeah. Does that answer the question?
Very much so.
Okay.
So cool. Once I get buy-in, I understand what I'm doing. Maybe I've taken some surveys or I've had various conversations with a lot of different people in my company to figure out what do they want. Do I put together a corporate wellness plan? Do I hire someone like you in your company to help me do it? Are there situations where I might have two different companies figuring this out? So I have one consultant that comes in and tells me this is what my corporate plan could be, and then I go out and source all the different players that could do that. What does that look like?
So yeah, let's take it just a couple steps back from the beginning, right? The beginning is really the research phase. We call it at our company the discovery phase. But from if you're, you know, an HR person at a company and you are like, you know, you're listening to this podcast and you're like, this sounds great, I want to do this. Step one is research this new wave of corporate wellness. Read the articles that come up when you Google, does corporate wellness work? And that say, corporate wellness is a sham. Corporate wellness doesn't matter. Corporate wellness is hokey. Read those articles because you don't want to get stuck in the trap, in the sales pitch of all these corporate wellness companies out there that drive you back into that short-term ROI that's loosely correlated in some ways to healthcare premiums. Like, educate yourself on what not to do. Then educate yourself on what your employees, what your team, what you want to do. Engage in those surveys. Have town halls where you bring in healthy food and talk to your team about, you know, hey guys, what would make the workplace a better place to work? And this is what we do. I'll just tell you what we do with our companies is we focus on five pillars: physical fitness. So that's everything from exercise to nutrition education to ergonomics, you know, mental, emotional well-being. So that's stress reduction, you know, teaching people skills of habit creation, meditation and mindfulness. Then there's community support. So that's all of your happy hours. Like have your happy hours, have your birthday parties, have your potlucks, have hikes outside with your team where people can get together and just engage in a space that's outside of the normal realm of the office dynamic. And the next is financial health. Make sure that you're, you know, ask your employees, how can we provide you guys with financial resources and education other than salary, other than benefits that really make a difference in the way that you are going to be able to spend your money to create and live the life that you want. And finally, it's environmental sustainability. So that's the environment within your office, making sure that you have collaborative spaces, making sure that you, your office is aesthetically beautiful. Maybe you have full spectrum lighting in your office, you know, asking people, do you feel connected to nature? Like, are there ways that we can bring nature into the office or take you out into nature? Ask them on that word holistic level, taking it away from holistic energy chakras and crystals and bringing it more into, you know, interconnecting these elements of wellness that we all know on a personal level. You know, you need to have a balanced lifestyle of your different aspects of your life that make you happy. So the first part is research externally. The second is research internally. The third is to plan. So that's kind of what we're talking about now, you know, is this, and this is, this is what I would do in tandem with in an ideal world, but or before really going in and presenting this for that final approval, stamp of approval, buy-in from, you know, your CFO or whoever is signing the checks. And this part is to make that plan. So keep in mind starting small. Our company is, you know, this is what we do. We take people all the way through this process from the discovery to the planning to the execution, but you can do the planning yourself. I want to make that like fundamentally clear from my perspective. You know, our company is like an awesome yoga teacher, an amazing yoga teacher. If they are, they make you feel so empowered and so good and so in control of your own fitness and your own spirit, like, you know, mental journey, that if they got up and moved to Costa Rica to teach yoga retreats for the rest of their life and totally left you in the dust, you would feel not like, oh my God, they're gone, I can't do yoga anymore. You would feel like, oh my gosh, I have learned so much from this. Now I can do it myself. And so that's really the objective of our company is to help our clients to learn how to do this process. We walk them through it, but leave them in the ownership of the experience so that they can take this and decide what to do, decide which programs they want to prioritize, select vendors, engage with those vendors, maintain internal communications, you know, figure out how to build recruitment kits and advertise, you know, out for recruiting purposes with what they're doing, continually evolve their program, you know, but we also do that with our clients. But that's the next step of the process is planning. All right, so you have all this research, you have what you want to do. Now, how are you going to do it? Start small, start with a couple, you know, engagement initiatives that match your budget, and then see how they go. Take a second afterwards, ask people around, you know, how could we do this better? What could we have done next time? That's that planning section. What are we going to start with? Starting small. And then once you have a plan, I would recommend with our clients, we usually do a discovery program and then a one-year plan, a pilot year. So plan your pilot year and then go to that check signer, that person who's got that stamp of approval and say, hey, here's what we're going to do. Here's how we're going to do it. Here's why we're going to do it. These are the resources that I need. This is the time that I need allotted. And, you know, this is what's going to happen. And then no one's confused, right? No one's confused of what's going to happen and when it's going to happen and how much it's going to cost. So that would be the plan. Research outside, research inside, determine your timeline, and then get approval and execute.
So last question of this section. So no one will have to start from scratch, and they can build on top of the learnings that you've gained from working with a variety of companies. What are some of the hurdles and barriers and challenges that a company may go through as they go through this entire process, specifically in the execution phase? And with that, yeah, what are the last words that you also want to provide to people who are naysayers, people who think this is ridiculous, think that it's not real?
Absolutely. Okay, so there's a couple different parts of that question. The first one is the hurdles, and the second is, you know, final words to the naysayers or the people who think that it's not real. So let's start with the hurdles. A huge hurdle that I find that people run into at the start of this is that they're afraid to ask questions because they don't want to know the negative answers. Now, that's kind of like, if we bring that back to a personal level, right? That's like the person who doesn't want to write down the food that they're eating because they don't want to see, oh my God, I ate 4 bags of Fritos today and they were delicious, but I totally ate all 4 of them, you know? But what I would say to that is, when you're collecting this information, when you're collecting this quantitative and qualitative data from your team, use data to guide, not to grade. You need to use data as a tool to know where to look next, not as an assessment of how good you are, right? On a personal level, we understand this fundamentally. When we would get, you know, there are a lot of people out there who didn't do well taking tests. And if people got back a test and they know that they're a smart person and they got a C on a test for a myriad of different reasons, and they look at that C and they think, I am average, I'm never going to be better than this, I can never change. That's a fixed mindset, and that's going to determine their actions moving forward. So the first hurdle is to know that the results of your data are not a determination of the potential for your company, your culture, or your wellness program. They are a wonderful and beautiful place to start. If you find something in the data that you're like, oof, that makes you cringe, that you're like, oh, I didn't want to see that, perfect. Now you know what one step you can take to make your company a slightly better place is. You found a point to start at. And that is the key. That's what, you know, we're all looking for, is like, how can we make our companies a better place to live and to work? We spend, you know, a third of our life at work. We live here. So that would be a first one in the discovery phase, in the research phase. In the execution phase, you're going to mess up. You're going to have things that flop. You're going to have things that soar. You're going to have moments where you're like, oh my gosh, I'm brilliant and I'm so good at corporate wellness and culture is awesome and my team's amazing and everyone's eating kale, you know? And you're going to have moments where you're like, I just spent 5 hours trying to bring in, you know, this lunch and learn on how body language affects sales and no one showed up. That's okay. You know, one of the core principles of our company, of On the Goga, is practice your practice. When you are practicing yoga, you don't have to be an expert yogi to get on a yoga mat. Like, all you have to do to get from that person who's completely inflexible, like me 5 or 6 years ago, totally inflexible, has no coordination, no athleticism, to the person who can do handstands and headstands and is always telling their friends, like, let's go on a walking meeting. The only difference between the start and the end is that you have the willingness to get on your yoga mat over and over again and fail, to have moments where you're like, what am I even doing here? Like, this totally didn't work, you know, because you have to have those moments of no one showing up, of things not working, to understand better the environment that you're trying to create this culture for. So in the execution phase, it's really about not judging your entire program and all of your work on the result of one effort or one effort one time. You know, it's taking those things, noticing what works, and equally as important, noticing what doesn't work, because that's what's going to allow you over time to figure out what's the best solution here. So I would say that's the biggest hurdle in the execution phase is don't get bogged down and don't set unrealistic expectations for yourself or for the, you know, the person who's signing the checks. Don't tell them we're going to do this and we're going to have 80% engagement. You know, we're going to do this because this is what people want and we're going to figure out how to deliver it to them in a way that makes sense for them. But that's going to take everyone here time. This is a learning experience and, you know, we're not going to set an unrealistic expectation that's setting us up for failure because we can't meet it. I would say those are probably the two major hurdles. And then in terms of final words to people who think, you know, this is bullshit, essentially, like, this isn't real, I don't care about this, I have more important things to think about, I would simply ask the question, how do you want to spend your day? A lot of the time, we live under this belief that work is, I think, I'm all about this. If you haven't been to Disrupt HR, you really need to go. I'm all about Disrupt HR today because, you know, it was just the other day and it's someone in there said, you know, their grandfather says work is a four-letter word for a reason. This is something that we're taught from such a young age. All of the movies we've ever watched, all of the TV shows we've ever watched, you know, all of the, when we see our parents coming home from work so stressed out at a young age, like when we played pretend as kids that we were going to be adults, it was like, oh, sorry, I can't talk. I need to take this phone call, you know, coming home from work, just being exhausted. Right? That's like, that's right. How we've thought about work for so long. And my question for those naysayers is, how do you want to spend your day? If you want to spend your day in this grind of, I go to work because I have to, but it's never really going to get better. I can't have these things that I want. I don't have the tools. I don't have the resources, or I'm just not that person. If you really believe that and you're happy with that, do that, because I'm all about doing what makes you happy. But if you think that and you think, man, it would really be awesome to work at a place where communication was prioritized effectively and in practice every day. It would really be great to go to a place where I don't have to even leave the office to work out, exercise, eat right. I would love to work in a place where I know that if I'm taking time for personal development and family life, my company knows that that's making me a better worker. If that's the place where you want to live, then there are ways to create that in any environment. It's going to be harder in some environments than other environments. It's going to take more time. It's going to take more resources. It's going to take different amounts of time and different resources in different places. But change and growth is objectively possible through habit creation. So the question isn't really like, does this work? The question is, do you want to do it? And if you want to do it, there's so many resources out there for you to find out how.
Nice. I am so excited about your excitement. This makes me...
I'm so glad.
I feel like I'm about to put on my yoga clothes and pull out the mat and just do you right now while we're doing the podcast.
Yeah. You know, here's the beautiful thing about it. You could take out your yoga clothes and you could get on a mat and do that, or you could sit back and crack it. Well, it's 10 a.m., so maybe it's a little early. But, you know, I tell people all the time, you could sit on your couch holding your cat in one hand and holding a glass of wine in the other and taking a deep breath and just, like, noticing where you are. Like, that is the feeling of wellness in a lot of ways. You know, wellness doesn't have to be the kale juicing super Instagram yogi. You know, wellness can be the day that you take off of work to spend time with your kids and go see their play. You know, wellness means different things for different people.
I like that. And I hope people were taking notes, because you definitely dropped a lot of gems, a lot of wisdom, and a lot of insight for a lot of people who especially are on the fence about wanting to do something like this for 2018. So I hope you guys were paying attention. So now we're going to go into one of my favorite sections of the podcast, which is called The Real, The Random, and The Ridiculous, where I ask you a real question, a random question, and a ridiculous one. Are you ready?
I'm so ready.
Real question number one. I know you're all about your mindfulness and wellness, and I know you're pretty healthy, but I have to ask, do you like bread pudding? And if so, how do you like it made?
So I was prepared for this question because I had heard you reference the bread pudding. And I am bread pudding, to be honest, is not my go-to dessert. My go-to dessert is ice cream 100% of the time. But I will say that the other day I accidentally made bread pudding by undercooking a paleo banana bread, and it was delicious. So I feel you on the bread pudding.
Huh. So you're an accidental fan of bread pudding.
An accidental bread pudding connoisseur at this point, I think you could say.
I don't know if we can go that far. But I take my connoisseur level of bread pudding very seriously. So I don't know if we can say that, but whether it's accidentally or it's intentionally, I'm glad somehow or another you fell in love with bread pudding. That's awesome. Okay, the random question. So I'm assuming with you being in wellness and mindfulness and actually teaching yoga, I mean, you actually do teach some of the yoga classes yourself, right?
Oh, yeah.
So to me, that means that a lot of times you're in some type of yoga workout clothes. I know the cool kids today call it athleisure. So I know.
Are those the cool kids?
I guess.
Are they really?
I guess. I guess that's what I've been told. It's called athleisure because a lot of people are wearing workout clothes everywhere and not getting dressed up anymore. So my question for you, being that outside of my office, a block either way, there's three big box athleisure brands. There's Lululemon or Lululemon. Never knew how to pronounce that. There's Athleta, and there's Under Armour. I can't believe it. They're all, to me, overpriced, super expensive, but the lines are always out the door. People are in and out with their kale shakes and their salads, in and out, running, just buying as much of it as possible. So what is your favorite brand? If it's in it, it could be one of those three, or it could be wherever you get your workout clothes from. I'm curious.
Yeah, so I'm not a huge, you know, brand loyalist to any of the major brands. I will say that the jacket I have from Lululemon, it's the one piece of Lululemon clothing that I own. I always get compliments on it, and it kind of tears me up inside. I try so hard not to, you know, live into the stereotypes of the proselytizing yogi friend, but here I am owning a Lululemon jacket and driving an orange Prius, so I can only do so much. I would honestly take a second to shout out to a brand that I truly love and believe in. It's a little bit more on the woo-woo side, but it's a brand called Spiritual Gangster. They make, I guess you could call it athleisure clothing, but they're an incredibly value-oriented company that makes awesome clothing that is designed to inspire people to take the yoga lifestyle off the mat. So it's definitely not a brand for everybody, but I think they're a wonderful company, and I really love their clothing.
Nice. And then final question, the ridiculous one. What is the most ridiculous thing that you've ever heard someone say about yoga? What makes you just want to just tear your hair out when you hear somebody say something about yoga? Tell me about it.
So I guess, you know, the thing that really, there's so many things about yoga. I guess I could say this about, because I think yoga is really misunderstood in a lot of different ways. And I think that people, even who practice yoga, take it and use it in a lot of different ways. But I guess the major thing is when people say, so is yoga a religion? That really, I guess you could say, gets me excited to respond that it's not. Because yoga, the word yoga, comes from the Sanskrit word yog, which means union. So it's there's different ways to interpret that, but essentially in the practice, the physical practice of yoga, it's the any time where your physical attention and your mental attention is focused on the same thing. So that's why I like to say the easiest form of yoga is simply to notice what you're doing with your hands. Right? Because a moment ago, you had hands, and they were doing something, but it's that one moment of like, oh, right, I'm here. So that yoga, that state of yoga, there's a quote by a woman named Sharon Gannon, who is a yoga teacher, who is credited a lot of bringing yoga to the West. And she says, you can't practice yoga. Yoga is your natural state. What you can do are yoga exercises to notice where you're resisting your natural state. So you can, the practice of yoga is really just a state of being. It's not a certain act. It's not we're not doing these different yoga poses to, connect to anything other than ourselves, other than to this particular moment right here. And so when people say is yoga religion? No, it's really not. People, you could use yoga as a form of, when you look at the brains of someone meditating and someone praying, they look very similar, different, similar parts of the brain are being activated. So I'm sure you could use yoga as a form of prayer. You could do all that stuff, but yoga itself, one of my greatest friends, their yoga is surfing. Mm. When they're on that surfboard, you can't be thinking about, the thing that's to come or the thing that, just happened. You have to be focused in that moment on where am I? Where is my body? Where is my breath? Where is my balance? And that moment of total focus and total unity of your body and your mind in this moment, which is the only moment that's occurring, that is yoga.
On that note, this has been an amazing podcast episode. Anna, thank you so much for being such an awesome guest, for dropping so much wisdom, and for even making me a believer of yoga. So, thank you.
Woo! Thank you, Bruce, so much. So happy to be on.
So, where can people find you and On the Goga on the internet?
Yeah, so if you're even having an inkling of this sounds awesome, and I would love some just support or help in figuring out what first step to take, you can find us online at www.onthegoga.com. That's onthegoga.com. We keep it simple here, so all of our social media tags are at onthegoga. And you can reach out to us through either of those, and we can start to talk about how we can make your workplace the best place to be.
Well, thanks again for making this an awesome podcast and having a great conversation. We look forward to people actually reaching out to you who are interested in this. But for all you HR people out there, thanks again for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, if you enjoy yoga, if you enjoy yoga pants, give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. And please subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast player. And as always, stay tuned for the next episode. And remember, HR folks, remember to hire, train, and retain the best workforce possible. Thanks again. Later, kids.